There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
New Year, and welcome to the January 2010 edition of No One's Legal Radio. We're part of the CKUT Community News Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. On this month's show, we preview the upcoming Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity, which will take place at the end of the month, January 29th to 31st, at the Park Extension Community Center. The Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity is a Montreal-based collaborative effort by grassroots social justice activists and community organizers to create a space that will allow for discussion, sharing experiences, and developing strategies in the ongoing struggle to live free of police violence. This month's show is a special preview of some of the panels and workshops at the Forum, including police profiling of street youth and youth of color in Montreal, Justice Without Police, a workshop on community alternatives to policing, families speaking out against police killings and impunity, and the opening panel on January 29th entitled No Justice, No Peace, Why People Leave the Police. We'll be hearing interviews shortly with Neil Castro of Capitang Montreal, Loira Limbaugh of Sister to Sister from Brooklyn, Francine Registre, sister of Kilem Registre, who died after repeated taser shocks by the Montreal police in Saint-Michel, and Will Prosper of Montréal République and the Coalition Against Police Repression and Abuse, and a former RCMP officer. This month's show is produced by members of the No One's Legal Network in Montreal in conjunction with the CKUT Community News Collective. No One's Legal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance, fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Robin Maynard, a member of No One Is Illegal Montreal, with my co-host, Jaggy Singh. On today's show, we're previewing the upcoming Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity, which will take place at the end of the month, January 29th to 31st, at the Park Extension Community Center. We'll feature four panels and workshops at the Forum on today's show. For details about the Forum, we encourage you to check out the website, www.forumcontrelaviolencepolicière.net. Our first interview is with Neil Castro, a member of Capitang Montreal. Capitang Montreal is a Filipino youth organization that combats systemic racism. They've been publicly vocal many times about police harassment of Filipino youth. A member of Capitaine Montreal will be part of the panel called At Risk Youth, At Risk From Whom? Police Profiling of Street Youth and Youth of Color. This workshop, prioritizing the voices of youth, will also feature community members who work in other so-called at-risk communities, including sex workers and drug users. The workshop will also address the criminalization of hip-hop. We'll go to the interview that I did with Neil right now. I'm speaking with Neil Castro of Cabotang Montreal, a Filipino youth organization. Neil is on a panel called At-Risk Youth, At-Risk From Who? Youth and Police Profiling. Neil, it's really great to have you on the show. Could you tell us a little bit about Cabotang Montreal, its history and its goals?
Yes, Robin, thank you so much for having me on the show. Glad that we can that Filipino youth can have a voice on issues like the ones we're addressing at this this forum. A little bit about KM. We were founded, Cabotang Montreal KM. We are the Filipino youth organization in Montreal, and we were founded in 2000 to address the issues of Filipino youth, particularly in Montreal, but also relating them to the experiences of Filipino youth across Canada. 2010 will actually mark 10 years of Filipino youth organizing here in Montreal, so we're very proud for that achievement. But through our years of experience, we've been able to really sharpen our analysis, enabling our organization to focus on the major areas that contribute to our community's marginalization. Like we are fighting for our community's genuine and just settlement and integration into Canadian society. That is, let me be clear, it's our community's version of settlement and integration, not necessarily the version of the Canadian state. So in particular, when we look at that that focus of our work, we are looking at our economic marginalization, our experiences with systemic racism, and also the issues of our Filipino women and Filipino youth.
Yeah. All right. Can I get you to talk a little bit about racial profiling, the harassment and violence faced by Filipino youth in Montreal?
Well, just to note that there are actually many, many factors contributing to the Filipino community's marginalization. As I stated just earlier in the description of KM, but instead of addressing these root causes of our marginalization, what we get is an increase of police presence. The police who do not primarily serve the interests of immigrant and other marginalized communities here in Montreal. These police are sent out to deal, quote-unquote, with our troubled youth. None of I know for a fact, none of our youth grew up with the intention to live a troubled existence. But by stigmatizing them as criminals is absolutely a step in the wrong direction. So, you know, that's how we're looking at it, and it's disturbing, really, to hear reports. Like we get reports, especially an increase of reports when the weather gets warm outside, and more youth are visible on the streets. We get these reports of our youth that wherever they go in the neighborhood, they are harassed from schools, parks to basketball courts, even storefronts. So they're experiencing either physical, psychological, verbally, sometimes even just menacing stares coming from the police force. So they always want us, the police always want us, marginalized communities, to understand what they are going through and that they're just doing their jobs and, you know, it's a stressful occupation, but they are not the ones, right, living a marginalized existence.
Yeah, on that note, I want to ask the next question, which is that lots of racialized communities, like in Montreal Nord and in NDG, see the youth specifically targeted by means of supposed anti-gang legislation. Can you talk a little more about the idea of gangs and how this ends up affecting youth in the Filipino community here in Montreal?
Oh, right, yeah, well, that, like I mentioned just before, the stigmatization of our youth as criminals, right? We don't want that to happen. It's not a step in the right direction. Anti-gang police forces in marginalized communities in Montreal, why are they only in these particular communities, right? Don't we all live in the same city? and if you look at the effect of their presence there, you know, they had their so-called campaigns against gangs and all that, but was there really any change in the amount of drugs in these areas? Have the development of the communities been directly impacted by these initiatives from the anti-gang police forces? From our point of view, not much, not really, right? So point of view of a marginalized community like the Filipino community, we don't see it. It didn't really change much. We're still on the sidelines. We're still economically marginalized. We're still experiencing daily systemic racism, and there's still major issues amongst our women and youth. So what I really see the anti-gang initiatives accomplishing is putting fear into our youth, not trust. This is the experience over and over and over again. Every time they come up with this anti-gang initiative, and these police tactics of repression and violence, they just remain the same. And the fact that when this is brought up to all levels of government in the city and the province and all that, the fact that nothing is being done about it, even though there is evidence of its negative impacts, that's how we see it as a larger systemic issue.
And how does Cabotang Montreal try to fight back against this kind of violence and profiling that's happening?
Right. Well, our particular focus with our youth, Filipino youth, is really education. Education. There's a misbelief that all the education you need is in that institution they call school. But we know that there's a lot of things that our community, especially particularly our youth, they're not learning about what the experiences that they're going through, the barriers that they're facing, why there's such a high dropout rate. So we do continuous education. Our programs are always filled with educational workshops, discussions. Even when we have concerts and shows and activities, there's always some kind of educational element to it so that we can bring back our experiences, talk about that, and learn from them and find ways to move forward from them.
All right, and my last question for you, Neil, is does Cabotang think that it's important to try to create solidarity with other communities, especially youth who are profiled in the city, either through racial profiling or social profiling?
Absolutely. I think it's important. A lot of the tactics that are used is really meant to further divide us, right, to make us look and see that community being, you know, arrested for something or being attacked for another thing. And it doesn't, there's no systems in place that actually encourage these different groups to get together and really sit down and talk out the issues that we're going through, issues like the experience we get from the police and even the greater issues that are faced by all these immigrant communities and marginalized communities. So definitely, I think it's very important that we keep an open dialogue between different groups and really continue to raise the questions and deepen our understanding of all our experiences. And we'll see that we're not alone. Our communities aren't alone in our marginalizations. And that actually if we all band together and work together towards the factors and the barriers that are oppressing us and repressing our communities and marginalizing us, we'll see that we will have a better chance of winning that struggle for genuine development for our communities. Yes, we're really glad our fight to really look at the systemic racism is one of our major campaigns to fight systemic racism. So we're really excited to be part of this, to share our experience, and to also learn from the other groups who are in the same struggle as us when it comes to the police.
Okay, Neil, well, thank you so much. It was great to have you on the air, and looking forward to your panel, which is on this Saturday.
Thank you as well.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Depuis la Nueva, Zidane était jeune, tiré par un agent du SPDM. Il était bien chill dans le territoire hostile, mais dès qu'il est devenu victime, à tête d'un projectile. What the fuck? C'est les coches, c'est la population. Aucune relation, aucune connexion.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One's Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Jaggy Singh, here in studio with my co-host, Robin Maynard. We're both members of No One's Legal Montreal. The track you're hearing right now was put together by several local hip-hop artists in the aftermath of the shooting death of Freddie Villanueva in Montréal-Nord in August 2008. In October of 2007, Kilem Registre was killed as a result of a taser attack by the Montreal police in Saint-Michel. The Registre family, the Villanueva family, the Bennis family are all at the forefront of demanding justice and accountability for their loved ones. One of the panels at the upcoming Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity will feature these voices. So on today's show, we're going to hear from Francine Registre. Francine is the sister of Kilem Registre. She works in the healthcare sector, but she's also an organizer and activist demanding justice and accountability in the case of her brother, Kilem, who was brutally tasered by the Montreal police in very suspicious circumstances. She talks about those issues in this interview. The interview is in French. Francine's more comfortable in French, so we'll go to that interview with Francine Registre right now.
Je suis sur la ligne avec Francine Registre. Francine, c'est une travailleuse dans le secteur de la santé ici à Montréal. Et Francine est également le sœur de Kilem Registre. Kilem Registre qui était tué par les policiers de Montréal en octobre 2007. Francine, bienvenue à Radio Personnalité Légale.
Merci, bonjour. Je suis enchantée d'être présente avec vous.
Francine, vous allez participer sur un panel au Forum contre la violence policière et l'impunité en fin janvier. Le panel est titré « Plus jamais, des familles dénoncent les bavures policières et l'impunité ». Je veux commencer avec les détails de qu'est-ce qui se passait en octobre 2007 et après, quand Kilem était tué par l'SPVM ici à Montréal.
Bon, tout d'abord, selon ce que nous avons appris, c'est qu'il a été intercepté par des policiers, puis les policiers ont dégainé leurs petits organes très, très rapidement, sans se questionner si l'état de santé de Kilem était correct ou pas. Ils ont simplement agi là sur un coup de tête, selon moi. Une fois arrivés à l'hôpital, ils nous ont fait comprendre tout d'abord que c'était un accident d'auto, ce qui a empêché mon frère, Kilem Registre, à avoir les soins nécessaires pour que les médecins puissent lui donner les soins pour qu'il puisse survivre au choc électrique qu'il a subi avec les taser guns. Ça, c'est un manque, selon moi. Puis, deuxièmement, il nous a fallu beaucoup de questionnement, d'aller à la télé pour savoir, pour avoir exactement ce qui s'était passé. Puis également, les médecins ont dû appeler les policiers pour avoir des détails de l'arrestation qui a eu lieu avec Kilem Registre.
Francine, je me rappelle une manifestation à Saint-Michel, pas loin le lieu où Kilem est décédé, où il était abattu par les policiers, parce qu'il était décédé dans l'hôpital après. Mais je me rappelle une manifestation à Saint-Michel quelques jours après la mort de Kilem. Et je voudrais que vous parliez de les différentes démarches, les différentes choses que vous et votre famille et votre soutien en fait pour qu'il y ait justice dans ce cas. C'est quoi les différentes choses que vous avez fait pour demander des réponses et de la justice dans cet cas de bavure policière?
Tout d'abord, nous avons fait appel à un avocat. Puis par la suite, nous avons fait une demande à la déontologie pour avoir un peu de lumière sur le cas, sur la façon de procéder des policiers. Et puis, en plus de la manifestation, une demande d'enquête publique a été demandée. Nous avons participé à plusieurs conférences sur l'usage de taser gun pour l'interdire. Donc, nous avons demandé plusieurs fois une demande d'une enquête publique qui est jusqu'à maintenant que nous n'avons pas eu de réponse, qu'on attend toujours.
Et parler plus de cette démarche, de quoi ça prend pour qu'il y ait la justice, c'est maintenant plus que 2 ans après le mort de Kilem. Il n'y a toujours pas une réponse claire de qu'est-ce qui vraiment a passé cette journée-là où Kilem était abattu par les policiers. Parlez plus de le sentiment de quoi, qu'est-ce qu'il faut faire pour qu'il y ait des réponses dans ce cas.
Bon, nous autres, en tant que famille de la victime, pour avoir de la justice, c'est un démarche qui est très dur, parce que sinon, nous, les politiciens, pour eux, dès qu'il s'agit des policiers, les policiers ont toujours raison, puis nous autres, le petit peuple, nous avons tort. Donc, c'est des démarches qui ont été très, très longues, puis jusqu'à maintenant, malgré toutes ces démarches-là, toutes les manifestations, toutes nos sorties à la télé, malgré qu'ils ont conclu que le taser était une arme qui pouvait tuer, malgré tout ça, jamais nous avons eu des réponses concrètes. Jamais qu'on a eu du ministre Dupuis ou quiconque qui se penche sur le dossier pour nous donner vraiment une réponse. Pour eux, simplement faire le rapport du coroner, c'est supposé nous satisfaire puis nous fermer la bouche, puis ça restait là. Non, ça ne resterait pas là parce que les policiers, ils ont tort, puis c'est par rapport à l'enquête qui a eu lieu de Radio-Canada et puis plusieurs d'autres compagnies. Oui, et le taser, c'est un arme qui est dangereux. Puis deuxièmement, nous voulons toujours justice, quoique les policiers ont été, par rapport à l'endéologie, ont été cités. Jusqu'à maintenant, on n'a pas encore eu de date d'audience. Donc on est là, on fait des démarches, on parle, on essaie d'avoir des informations, des informations, des réponses qui viennent jamais. Donc oui, pour nous, en tant que parents de la victime, on n'est pas vraiment considéré dès qu'il s'agit des policiers. C'est ce qu'on trouve qui est vraiment pénible.
Et contrairement aux réponses claires de qu'est-ce qui se passait, vous avez reçu d'autres réponses à part des policiers, et ça, c'est toutes sortes de choses qui étaient dites autour de la réputation de Kilem, salissage, etc. Parlez de ça, parlez de cette réponse des policiers et comment vous pouvez contrer cet salissage qui arrive chaque fois qu'un incident comme ça arrive et les policiers sont responsables pour le mort de quelqu'un?
Mais moi, ce que je trouve dommage, c'est que pour justifier l'acte des policiers, c'est très important pour eux là de faire une campagne de salissage de réputation de la personne. Le victime, il est déjà victime, en plus de ça, qu'on salisse sa réputation sans toutefois vouloir sortir même le nom du policier. On ne connaît jamais les noms des policiers. Par contre, le dossier criminel ou le passé de la personne qui a pigé des peines, qui a été fait également par cette personne-là. Et je pense qu'il a toujours été payé par rapport le temps que la personne a passé en prison. Ils reviennent toujours sur le dossier passé criminel ou quoi que ce soit de cette personne-là pour salir sa réputation malgré qu'il est décédé. Mais je pense que c'est vraiment pas juste. Et puis les policiers sont très, eux, les policiers qui sont des criminels en guillemets, ils sont toujours considérés comme des gens qui agissent pour la justice, puis ce qui a été fait par selon leur façon de fonctionner. Ce sont des policiers qui travaillent pour le gouvernement. C'est tout à fait compréhensible que le gouvernement ne veut pas non plus se salir. Ils veulent pas non plus punir leurs propres policiers. Donc, moi, je pense que c'est un cercle vicieux qu'on tourne toujours autour. Parce que les policiers travaillent pour le gouvernement. Nous autres, on est le petit peuple. C'est difficile de se battre contre Goliath. Puis le gouvernement, les policiers, c'est Goliath. Quoi qu'ils essaient de nous faire comprendre que c'est deux instances complètement différentes, moi, je dis non, c'est pas deux instances différentes parce qu'ils sont toujours en train de protéger les policiers et puis de salir la réputation de la victime, de la personne qui est qui est décédé, qui fait directement une répercussion sur la famille, parce que c'est la famille qui est présente, qui vit la situation. La personne est décédée, mais nous autres, en tant que famille, on est là. Puis donc, en un sens, on a également, ils sont en train de nous salir la réputation, au lieu de nous aider, de nous donner les réponses exactes, de nous donner un support. C'est pas du tout le cas. C'est plutôt plus les policiers qui sont protégés là-dessus par rapport au ministre de la Justice. Et puis, c'est ce qu'on trouve un petit peu pas trop agréable en tant que famille des victimes la plupart du temps.
Francine, quand nous avons parlé de cette démarche et la longue lutte pour justice dans le cas de qui l'aime, vous m'avez dit que une de les choses les plus importantes, c'est la famille. Et je voudrais que vous parlez plus et expliquez plus. Ça veut dire quoi quand vous disiez un de les sens le plus important, c'est l'importance de la famille?
Oui. Ce que je veux dire par là, c'est qu'une fois que la personne est hospitalisée, est en phase de, est près de la mort, la personne, mon frère, il ne peut pas nous parler, il ne peut pas exactement nous dire ce qui s'est passé. Et lorsqu'on demande aux autorités de savoir, de connaître ce qui s'est réellement passé, ils nous racontent des affaires qui se tiennent du tout pas debout. Des fois, je me pose la question, comme dans la situation de mon frère, je me dis, coudonc, est-ce qu'ils nous prennent pour des imbéciles, des illettrés, venir nous voir, nous raconter des histoires qui se tiennent vraiment pas debout? Au moins, ils ont la décence de réviser leur contenu pour savoir avec qui exactement ils parlent. Et au moins, raconter une histoire qui se tienne plus ou moins, qui a un peu de bon sens, nous dire carrément qu'il est décédé d'une overdose tandis qu'il a réussi 6 décharges électriques de quasiment 50 000 volts chaque. Donc, on peut bien faire les comptes entre une dose de cocaïne et une surcharge d'électricité. Donc, ils prennent vraiment pas en considération la famille. Ils nous racontent des histoires qui ne se tiennent pas debout. Ils viennent nous rencontrer, nous expliquer tous les enquêteurs. Moi, nous avons vraiment pas apprécié la façon de procéder des enquêteurs. C'est une des raisons d'avoir une instance qui a vraiment pas neutre et non la police qui enquête sur la police, parce qu'ils prennent nos déclarations à nous pour monter le dossier des policiers, pour monter les dossiers et les contenus pour les policiers, pour qu'ils puissent avoir un vrai bon sens et pour pouvoir aussi nous discréditer la personne qui est victime et monter le policier qui est criminel en quelque sorte.
Francine, vous allez participer sur un panel au Forum contre la violence policière et l'impunité. Le panel est titré « Plus jamais, des familles dénoncent les bavures policières et l'impunité ». Et vous allez partager le panel avec d'autres membres de famille qui sont dans les cas semblables, les membres de famille qui étaient confrontés de toutes sortes de barrières dans leur quête pour la vérité dans les circonstances des morts de leurs proches. Et je veux savoir, c'est quoi les leçons, c'est quoi les conseils que vous voulez donner aux autres personnes qui dans la situation semblable que vous?
Bon, moi, tout d'abord, je leur dirais, en premier lieu, lorsqu'on en entend des histoires concernant un enfant qui est décédé et que les policiers ont tiré tout dépendant, on fait confiance tout de suite à l'agent, aux policiers, aux enquêteurs. Et pourtant, oui, c'est normal qu'on est supposé de leur faire confiance. Ils sont là, ils représentent la justice. Mais il faut les faire confiance avec beaucoup de réserve. Pas trop leur en dire également. Et j'ai l'impression que lorsqu'on leur dit plus, trop, ils les servent contre nous. Ils sont supposés d'être là pour nous supporter, pour nous aider. Au contraire, ça nous retourne sur le dos. Lorsque l'enquêteur est là pour enquêter par rapport, pour nous supporter, non, comme la famille Vinaleva, bon, j'ai parlé entre deux guillemets parce que je suis vraiment pas dans le dossier, mais ce que je puisse remarquer, le même procureur qui était dans le dossier à mon frère, qui était supposé de nous faire l'enquête puis nous aider, nous supporter, au contraire, moi, je vois qu'il est contre, il est en train de parler contre la famille. Donc, c'est comme si que c'est la famille contre la justice, ça n'a pas de sens. Moi, je trouve ça vraiment, c'est le monde à l'envers. D'être un petit peu plus prudent à ce qu'il raconte aux enquêteurs, justement, de la SQ, là, puis je pense que c'est une des choses que je leur dirais. Ça, c'est une erreur à ne pas faire, selon moi.
Francine, je vous remercie encore pour partager vos points de vue et vos réflexions avec nous à Radio Personnalité Égale. Et on attend votre intervention au Forum contre la violence policière et l'impunité au fin de mois de janvier. Merci encore, Francine.
C'est à moi de vous remercier.
Tuesday, February 23rd, beginning at sunset in Montreal, broadcasting live on your local campus and community radio station.
Sometimes we get that instant homelessness. We didn't expect to be homeless, and we find ourselves on the street because of an eviction or a notice.
Canada's largest talk show on poverty and homelessness.
We have a mayor who compared poor people to pigeons publicly and said that if you stop feeding them, they'll go away.
The 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, broadcasting February 23rd to 24th. A 14-hour live radio show from frozen street corners across Canada. Call in live, join the discussion.
Our demand from the federal government is $2 billion a year for social housing units across Canada. That'll just help us to start catching up to the 15 years that we've lost in building social housing in this country. It's really a glaring example of the negligence of the government.
Visit www.ckut.ca for more info.
Un message de Yves Francoeur, président de la Fraternité des policiers de Montréal.
Notre boulot à la police, c'est la répression. Nous n'avons pas besoin d'un agent socio-communautaire comme directeur, mais d'un général. Après tout, la police est un organisme paramilitaire, ne l'oublions pas.
Le Forum contre la violence policière et l'impunité, du 29 au 31 janvier 2010, au Centre communautaire de Parc Extension, situé au 419 Saint-Roch, Métro Parc.
The Forum is a space that will allow for discussion, sharing experiences, and developing strategies in the ongoing struggle to live free of police violence.
La meilleure façon de combattre l'harcèlement policier, le profilage et la violence est de forger des liens de solidarité et d'entraide à travers notre travail quotidien et nos campagnes diverses.
Join us for a weekend of workshops, roundtables, skill shares, testimonials, and more. For all the details, visit www.forumcontrelaviolencepolicière.net or call 514-398-3323.
Police partout, justice nulle part.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Je porte plainte contre l'homme, sa loi et ses normes, son képi et son arme, caché derrière un uniforme. Et l'enfoiré qui nous saigne, fait de nous des gens indignes, nous assigne et nous entraîne à cracher sur leur insigne. Je porte plainte contre vous, vous et vos collègues, qui faites de nous des gens à part et nous conformes à vos règles. Vous qui nous rabaissez, faites de nous des incultes, qui leur de cesser, qui ont fait de nous.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Illegal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Robin Maynard, a member of No One Is Illegal Montreal, along with my co-host, Jaggy Singh. Next up, an interview with Gloira Limbaugh. Gloira is an organizer with Sista to Sista from Brooklyn, New York. Sista to Sista was a collective of young, working-class Black and Latina women whose work included seeking community alternatives to policing in their community. Gloira is co-presenting a strategizing workshop at the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity titled Taking Care of Our Communities, Justice Without Police. We'll go to that interview right now. All right, I'm speaking with Gloira Limbaugh, also known as DJ Lalo, who is a filmmaker, activist, and DJ who lives in Brooklyn, New York. She recently directed and produced a documentary entitled Estilo Hip Hop. She's also a former organizer with Sista to Sista, a former organization for Black and Latino women. She's part of the panel in the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity called Taking Care of Our Communities, Justice Without Police. Gloira, it's great to have you on our show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
The workshop that you're giving is called Taking Care of Our Communities, Justice Without Police. Through your Freedom School for Young Women of Color, one of the focuses of your group was addressing violence against women of color through a program called Whose Streets Are Streets. It's important to confront violence in our communities. Could you talk a little bit about the failure of law enforcement structure and state-controlled service providers to fight violence within our communities?
Sure. First off, at least in the U.S., I'm not sure what the situation is in Canada, but in the U.S., the police have, as a professional group, they have one of the highest rates of domestic violence.
right? So if you compare, you know, police to, I don't know, doctors or, you know, janitors or construction workers or any other professional group, police officers have one of the highest rates of domestic violence, of committing, you know, domestic violence. And so, you know, and just that's one area, right, of violence against women. Violence against women takes a lot of shapes and forms and impacts, you know, a range of areas of women's lives. But if you want to take, you know, just that one example, the police itself, you know, it's like, how can you send out, you know, somebody that's perpetrating this crime at home to protect, you know, others? Obviously, there's going to be, you know, a contradiction. And, you know, that's obviously part of the culture of policing, you know, in the U.S. And so right there, you know, for us, that was like, well, we can't rely on police officers that feel it's okay to sort of beat their wives at home, you know, to then really, you know, address or, you know, really solve the problem of intimate or family violence in our communities. And then on top of that, you compound, you know, issues of racism, you know. And in New York, we kind of have this saying where, you know, from a certain point in Manhattan, from 96th Street down, which is sort of wealthier white communities, the police are there to serve and protect. And from 96th Street up, which is mostly Black, Latino, low-income folks, the police is here to control and repress, you know. And so the police in and of itself really can't, you know, solve any problems in our community because, one, we're not seen as, you know, full citizens or even full human beings most of the time. You know, we're looked at as a problem that needs to be contained, you know. And, you know, that's one facet, right, one side of the problem. Another, you know, side of the problem, which actually a group of young women, of teenage young women at Sister to Sister, produced a short documentary, a 10-minute piece called You Have the Right to Break the Silence. And it's a documentary that specifically looks at sexual harassment of young women in the community by police officers. You know, and so now we're talking about, you know, the day-to-day sexual harassment and violence that happens on the streets. And not only are young women facing that violence from, you know, men or young men or other folks in their community, but they're also facing it from the people that supposedly are there to serve and protect them, you know. So, you know, there's a myriad of, like, statistics, you know, that just point to the fact that police doesn't really, you know, address in any sort of adequate or efficient manner the problem of violence against women, you know. There was another point, we produced another documentary which looked at, it's called No More Violence Against My Sisters, and that piece looks at, it's a little bit longer, and it looks at different forms of violence, so economic violence, you know, domestic violence, sexual violence, and so on and so forth. And, you know, in that piece, it becomes, like, painfully clear, you know, how inadequate, you know, and ill-prepared the state and the police are to deal, you know, with the problem of violence against women. It's like, you know, these institutions are steeped in racism and in sexism and, you know, in a lot of ways, misogyny, a culture of misogyny, you know, those institutions. And so it's like, yeah, like they're never going to, you know, they're never going to be able to address our issues, you know?
Yeah, I think you're making a really good point there. And that actually leads to my next question, which is that as women of color, we've really come to understand that much of the violence that we face is systemic. Sister to Sister tried to create alternatives to turning to the police. Could you talk a little more about the challenges of trying to create a community-based system of accountability and justice to fight violence without resorting to the police? And maybe just give an example of what this looked like on the ground.
Sure. One of the organizing campaigns, or we can't even really call it a campaign because it doesn't fall into the sort of traditional organizing model of, you know, choosing an issue, choosing a target, you know, and then sort of, you know, addressing that target or protesting against that target to seek reform or to seek, you know, some sort of change. Like, we decided that instead of, you know, trying to advocate, you know, and picket in front of the police, the police precincts, to ask them to do more sensitivity trainings or whatever, or to improve community relationships, we decided to, you know, say we're not going to focus our energies over there. We're going to focus our energies in trying to envision and create a viable alternative to dealing with the issue, because the other reality is that there is an immense amount of violence that women of color face, you know, in all areas of their life, whether it be their employment or on the streets, in their homes. And, you know, it's like we can't sort of ignore that either. And so, okay, so what are we going to do? And for us, part of it, you know, was changing our focus and saying, you know, we're going to try to create this alternative, which we called Sisters Liberated Grounds. And our goal at the time was to create a zone, an area in the community. And, you know, we sort of looked at it like we're going to go about this very, you know, start off small and build off block by block, you know, create areas where in the community where violence against women wasn't tolerated, and that it would be that violence against women wouldn't be tolerated by community members. You know, and for us, that was sort of like the only real sort of long-term sustainable change. But again, that would have to be a very long-term sort of project, because it would, now you're talking about you're not talking about reforming an institution, something that can happen, you know, in a closed time period where you can say, you know, in the next 18 to 24 months, you know, we want to get this, I don't know, this passed or this policy changed or, you know, this law revoked or whatever. You're talking about changing the culture of the community. And I think that is perhaps one of our biggest challenges, is that we have all been raised in a society that is extremely, again, like I said before, sexist and misogynistic. And so we've all, you know, men, women, children, we've all come to see violence against women as something that's normal. It's become very normalized. For us, it was one of the first things was just to do a lot of community building, right? Like, you know, door to door, you know, knocking, having meetings and conversations with folks in their buildings, in the beauty salon, in the local bodega, wherever, you know, folks are at, trying to just start sort of a public dialogue about what we're trying to do and invite folks into our space or any community space where people already are to start having this conversation.
Okay, well, I think that's about all the time we had. Is there anything else you want to add specifically about police violence or about Sister to Sister's take on it?
No, you know, we're very excited to have been invited to the forum, and we're looking forward to being in Montreal. It'll be myself and another person who was a member of the Sister to Sister Collective, Isabel Gonzalez, who actually worked more directly with the Sisters Liberated Grounds project that we had going on. And so her insight will be very interesting to the folks that come to the workshop. And we're just really looking forward to the exchange, you know. So thank you for inviting us and for having me on the show tonight.
So this is a love song. So come and gather around you, people, and you listen to me act. All your doctors and your lawyers and your folks who push the crack. All the folks who push the buttons and the folks who push the mops. Come and listen while I tell you how I really like the cops. I really like the cops. I think they're really cool. I like them in my neighborhood. I like them in my school. I think the cops are wonderful. I think the cops are nice, and I
like to have a broken jaw and carry a pack of ice. I really like the cops, I think they're really neat. I like it when they take my face and smash it in the street. And then they take me to a station house and lock me in a room. And I love it when they rape me up the anus with a broom. I really like the cops, you know they make me sing. You know my favorite movie is that tape of Rodney King. So I really get pissed off whenever somebody like you suggests we should submit the cops to Citizens Review. I really like the cops. I really like the cops. I love those boys in the blue. I really like the cops. So glad that they're around to hassle me and ticket me for sitting on the ground. Really like the cops, I'd be so sad if they were gone. There's something about a uniform that always turns me on. I really like the cops, I think they're really cool. I like them in my neighborhood, I like them in my school. I think the cops are wonderful, I think the cops are nice. And I like to have a broken jaw and carry a pack of ice. I really like the cops, they always get me high. I hope that I get taken into custody and die. And I hope that every fact that's in the coroner's report gets chucked into a dumpster so it won't get heard in court. I really like the cops. Salute. I really like the cops. I love those boys in the blue. When I hear you making statements that I think are quite obscene, like how the cops are nasty, oh, like how the cops are mean, I think it's about some time that you should get yourself some class and help your local officer by kicking your own ass. So come and gather around your people, listen to me act. Your doctors and your lawyers and the folks who push the crack and all the folks who push the buttons and the folks who push the mops. Come and listen while I tell you how I really like the cops.
Welcome back. You're listening to No One's Legal Radio, a show about the frontline struggles for justice, dignity, and self-determination by migrants, refugees, and Indigenous peoples. We're part of Off the Hour at CKUT 90.3 FM. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. I'm your host, Jaggy Singh, here in studio with my co-host, Robin Maynard. We're both members of No One's Legal Montreal. The song we just heard is called I Love the Cops. It's sung by Brad Will. Brad Will was an activist, an organizer, an independent journalist. He was based in various places in the United States, but particularly in New York City. And Brad Will was in Oaxaca, Mexico, to cover an uprising there, particularly a teacher strike during the height of the uprising there in Oaxaca. And Brad Kill was shot down and murdered by officials that are alleged to have been involved or are paramilitaries or the police. So it's bittersweet to listen to that song because it's fun and it's funny. And you really get a sense of the playfulness of Brad and how he's full of life. But he's somebody who was shot down as he tried to cover as an independent journalist the teacher strike and uprising in Oaxaca. He makes reference in that song to being sodomized by a broomstick. And Brad's from New York, and he's referring there to the infamous incident of Abner Louima, a Haitian immigrant who was brutalized by the police in New York City. We're going to go to our last interview as part of our special show here, previewing the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity. That's going to take place at the end of the month, January 29th to 31st. The last interview is with Will Prosper. And you've heard Will Prosper on this show a few times, and you've probably heard him in other shows on CKUT and definitely in the mainstream media here in Montreal and in Quebec, because he's been quite outspoken since the death of Freddy Villanueva against police brutality, against racial profiling. He's a spokesperson for Moyen République. He is also a spokesperson for the Coalition Against Police Repression and Abuse. but he also happens to be someone who used to be an RCMP officer for 6 years. And Will is going to be a part of the opening panel at the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity on January 29th. It's taking place again up at the Park Extension Community Center. That opening panel is entitled No Justice, No Peace, Why People Leave the Police. That certainly applies in the case of Will Prosper, as well as at least one other panelist who used to be a member of the SPVM, which was probably called something else back in the 70s, and is now an outspoken anarchist community organizer in Point St. Charles. So to get a perspective on leaving the cops, and not just leaving a job, because that's pretty normal to leave your job, but to leave your job and to go on to become a social justice activist denouncing police brutality, we'll go to that interview that I did with Will Prosper right now.
I'm on the line with Will Prosper. Will is an organizer against police brutality here in Montreal. He is active with Morena République. He is also active with the Coalition Against Police Repression and Abuse. And Will be speaking on the opening panel at the upcoming Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity. The panel is entitled No Justice, No Peace, Why People Leave the Police. Will, welcome once again to No One's Legal Radio.
Well, thanks for having me, Jackie.
Will, you're on this opening panel, and everybody has a moment of surprise when they learn this, because you've been so outspoken in denouncing police abuses in Montreal over the past past year and more. You used to be an officer with the RCMP, so can you tell our listeners about your past involvement with the police? So when did you join? How long were you involved? Where were you stationed? Why did you get involved?
Well, I joined the RCMP while I was studying in Concordia University. Actually, I was studying philosophy, which has nothing to do with being a police officer. And a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to do the exam for the RCMP, and I said, okay, why not? Let's go for it. And I was also looking for a fast way to make a buck also, if you could say. So I think it was a good opportunity for me to do that. And also, I won't say it was a dream of mine to become a police officer, but it's something that I wanted to try to see how it was, and to see how it was from the inside also. So I passed the exam and everything, and I was finally posted in Manitoba, all the way up north on the First Nation territory, which was great for me because I was there for 2 years and a half, and I was way past the 54th parallel. So it was a great experience. I got to learn a lot from the community, and also from different kind of policing that we do with the band constable and other people and such. And it was, like I said, it was a great experience. Then I moved down south, close to Winnipeg, and I decided that being a RCMP officer wasn't for me, and I came back to Montreal to be a cinematographer, and that's what I always wanted to do.
Well, it's clearly an interesting personal trajectory, because you went from joining the RCMP, and I mean it's normal for people to have a job and to leave their job, but you not only left your job, but years down the road, you are one of the most outspoken voices here in Montreal in denouncing police brutality, and denouncing it not simply in saying, you know, we should improve police, or we should simply make the guns less deadly or what have you, but you're looking at a structure. You're looking at the police and criticizing the police in a structural way. You've talked about racial profiling. You've talked about poverty. You've addressed these issues quite articulately. So, talk a bit, and I know you'll be talking about this at length during the opening panel. But talk to us a bit about that trajectory. I think people can understand why you would have a job and leave a job, but how can you go from being in the RCMP to playing the role that you're playing now in terms of your organizing life?
Well, you have to understand that my father, when Anthony Griffith was killed by a police officer in Montreal 20 years ago, he was part of the marches and everything that went along to denounce the police brutality, and that's 20 years ago. So it's something, I guess, that runs into my blood also. As soon as I saw what happened to Freddy Villanueva, I realized that that could have been my nephew, it could have been a friend of mine, and it could have been me when I was younger, because these kind of situations could have happened to anybody. And I had some dealings with the police when I was younger. I faced racial profiling a lot. I was pulled over a lot of time, since not even like a couple of months ago, I was still pulled over, but I don't know if it's because I'm Will Prosper or if because I'm black. But anyways, I used to get pulled over a lot, so there was a lot of frustration within me also of the way that the police or certain police officer treat the citizen differently according to their color, their race, their gender, their social revenues. So that always pissed me off. And like I said, because of what my father was doing also 20 years ago, it's like I was taking the relay or le flambeau, like I said. And I think it was for my turn to say that that's enough, and we have to put an end to that. And I'm very criticizing the police force, especially on their mandate. And I think it's something that we should look at, because whenever you get in contact with a police officer, it's always for a ticket, always something negative. But when you get in contact with a fireman, let's say, it's never the same reason. It's always to save you or help you with something. And the police officers are looking for citizens to do something wrong, or not even to do something wrong. It's almost like they're looking for anything. If you're sitting on the sidewalk, if you're sitting improperly on the community, but a city apparel or stuff like that, well, they're looking for a reason to give you a ticket and to book you or to see who you are. And I think we have to change the mentality of police officers nowadays. And I mentioned that in the past. I feel that the police force, it's like a gang mentality sometimes, because if they see another police officers doing something wrong, they're afraid to denounce it because they're afraid that they will be left apart. So that's a big problem. Also, I know the La Fraternité des Policiers almost tried to pass a law that could prevent police officers seeing another police officer doing an offense, testifying against a police officer. They're trying to pass a law like that. So that tells me there's a problem that grows deeper in the roots of the mentality of the police force, and that has to be addressed.
Do you think that people should consider your trajectory to be unusual? Should we consider it unusual for people to leave the police and become social justice activists and organizers? Is that a unique thing, or is that something you can see us encouraging more and more in terms of encouraging people to leave the police force, denounce the abuses and the impunity that they see, and not just to leave, but to go on and to be involved in trying to make change in society?
Well, I can tell you for myself, I don't know if it's something that's going to keep on happening, but I can tell you something for sure. It's not something easy to do, because you always looked at, because I used to have some friends that were police officers, and we're talking with each other, and we have different points of views, and sometimes they feel not upset, but they try to understand why it's not even a switch side, because I was always like that while I was in the police force, and that's why sometimes I was perceived as an outsider that had a different approach. But it's not something easy to do also, because when you try to work in a community and you're working with some people that don't know the concept of being a police officer, and they figure out that you're still a police officer and you're still trying to get some information from them, some ex-gang members or some people surrounding them, it's something very tough for me to deal with from every day. But I think I've proven myself that that it's important to do that, and that we should address those different problematics that citizens are facing in every day, and we should have a better society. And we cannot accept our police force to keep on treating our citizens like that differently because of their race, their gender, and their social revenues. So we have to put an end to that. And it's funny, because in a society right now, when we talk to everybody, and everybody that don't think there's a problem, they always think that, well, what we got is perfect as it is right now, but we need to evolve from that, and we need to have a better system, and we need to address those different problems, because the world wasn't built in 100 years. It took a lot of years for the world to be built, and we have to reach for perfection and change the common idea that we have that right now we are at the best of all the worlds that we could have in the kind of society that we are living in right now. And even having a community police or trying to change the mandate of the police, because it's not true that the way that the police is acting right now is the right way. And even some people have been very open about that. But I think that some community could police themselves without the police. And I think that should be better for certain communities.
Will, you'll be addressing a lot of aspects of why people leave the police and your own personal story at the forum. You're speaking on the opening panel, which is going to take place on Friday, January 29th, at the Centre Communautaire à Parc Extension. But I'm interested in maybe going in a slightly different direction on this show, and that's to ask you about going from, you know, growing up here in Montreal, attending Concordia, growing up in Montréal-Nord, and then finding yourself, I know you're not always dressed up in the ceremonial Mountie garb, but being a Mountie and a police officer in northern Manitoba, you go from one reality, urban reality, where there's a certain type of poverty, racism, and apartheid, to another reality, northern Manitoba, where there's a whole other type of poverty, racism, and apartheid against an Aboriginal population, and you're there to police them. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that transition and your experiences in northern Manitoba when you were quite young, but still in an authority role in that community.
Well, like you said, it's quite funny how similar two different places are because of the social issues that they are facing, like Montreal North and the place I was working up north. And for me, it was a shock for me just to go to a place like nowhere else, all the way up north. I'm not used to go. I grew up in a city. I'm used to living in a city. And now I'm going to a First Nation territory where it's almost half of the year is always cold. And when I mean cold, it's under 40 degrees all the time, so for a long period of time. So, and we're quite isolated also. It was a 5 to 7 constable detachment. So for me to go to a place like that, coming from a city like Montreal, it was quite a shocker. And to see how the people were living as a community, it made me realize that we're not so different. And also, what shocked me the most is that, and what was important for me is that I never lived with the First Nation people, and I always heard the comments that they made on TV that the natives, they are drunk and stuff like that. You know, all those stereotypes that kept on living in a society that we get from television, the different medias. And for me to live in that community, you could understand the different problematics. And it was perhaps 5 to 10% of the people that were alcoholics, not even that much. And it's always the same people that we kept on arresting all the time. So you see that there's so many prejudices from outsiders of a certain community, and once you live in that community, you get to realize that that community is not different from where you're living at. In Montreal, North, I could show you it's almost the same thing, the same numbers. So you're always arresting the same people, but you always get to stereotype a certain community because you didn't get to live over there. And for me to live over there, it opened up my eyes on different issues that these people were facing as well, as isolated they were. And how come they didn't have no activities to do over there? If you wanted to do an activity, well, there's no movie theater, there's no skating park, there's no mall that you can go to, so there's nothing much to do. But still, they try to preserve a culture that is very rich and important for them. But for the youth, it's tough for them to grow in a community that you're so isolated, and you're looking at the outside world from the television, and you see all those things happening to those youth, and you can see that you cannot experience that. So that's just one of the many aspects that really affected me. But it was great for me as an experience because I could relate so much to the community and the natives because they understood that I lived some frustration. And I treat everybody the same. Everybody that I dealt with, I dealt with them like I was their brother. So for them, they always appreciate it when I intervene. Just to let you know, Jaggy, while I finish, is that when I was a police officer for 5 years, I only give one ticket, one speeding ticket, and that's it. So it tells you that for me, I'd like to have more of a discussion with a person and to talk with them and try to find a different solution. And I wasn't looking for somebody let's say somebody that was speeding, to give them a fine. I could talk to them and see if the next time we'll meet each other, well, that person won't be speeding. I think there's different ways that you can approach the people. But nevertheless, is that I was so much involved in the community. Also, I was coaching basketball. I was playing hockey. So I was also participating in powwows. And that's something that I wanted to do. It's not something that I was doing because I was a police officer. It's something that I was always doing. I've been coaching even now, even before, and it's something that I will keep on doing. But they could respect me for that because they see that I wasn't trying to get their, to fool them or try to connect with them. I was just doing that because that was me. That's the way I am. I wasn't trying to do something else. And I always dealt with them the same way that I would have dealt with my brother. So that was something that a lot of them told me afterwards. So it was a great experience for me.
Will, when you mentioned that in the course of 5 years you gave one ticket, for me that sort of begs the question. It begs the following question, and that is, if you didn't quit the police, would you have been kicked out? From what I know about other people's experiences of leaving the police, I come to that sort of same question as well, that people do quit. But if they didn't quit because of their character, their attitude, and the kinds of things that they were doing, they would have been kicked out anyways, because the kinds of things that are looked on positively from a social justice perspective aren't necessarily the kinds of things that make a good cop. And I'm not talking about getting involved in the community and stuff. I'm nuanced about it. A cop can be a cop and also be involved in their community. But I'm talking about, like, for example, that one anecdote that, you know, you only gave one ticket. So I'm wondering if you could maybe react to that. Is my somewhat critical question right? That if you weren't going to quit, you would have been kicked out. And a lot of people in the same situation find themselves facing that reality.
I think that's a good question. I think a lot of people face that reality, and I think I know a lot of people didn't like the way I was interacting with their people, the way I was connecting with everybody that I was working with, because I didn't just not work on the First Nation territory. I also work down south, and I was still coaching at that time. But it's just the way, just to give you an example, while I was working on the First Nation territory, there was one bar in that First Nation territory, one bar that everybody used to go there. And police forces or people that work as a policeman could not go to that bar. But for me, they was always inviting me, and I used to go to that bar. And I know a lot of people that I work with were not pleased with that, because most of the time that you could see some people that you just arrested or you might arrest and didn't even want to put you in a situation that something might happen to you, whatever the reason is. But I know that there's a lot of pressure for people not to intervene with a certain type of people, but I think, to come back to your question, I think that could be a factor with me a lot of time, the way I was acting, because it's not a question of authority, but it's just a question of the way I was interacting with everybody. Because for me, I could not give a ticket to somebody that was speeding because I was speeding for myself. I could not give a ticket for somebody speeding on the sidewalk because it's something that I do, and I don't feel that I should give a ticket to somebody that is 18 years old, doesn't have a job, and you give them a fine for that. I think it's better the way you intervene, that you talk to that person. And even if I see that person speeding, I don't even feel to tell them that you're not supposed to be speeding, because, you know, I think it's hard to be a person of authority and you don't want to ensure certain rules that are given by the government. And I think that's something that might have been looked at in a wrong way, especially for me, the way I was acting with the people. I think that was that might have been something that people would have didn't like about me as police officers, because I never also was looking to be part of the gang of police officer. I was always looking to be part of the community because it's something that I wanted to do. For me, being a police officer was just another job. It wasn't my life.
Will, there's so many more other things that I'd like to talk to you about. We can go on for hours, I think, but in the end, you are speaking on a panel, and people can hear more from you directly at the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity. So thanks, Will, for speaking with us on Noah's Legal Radio, and see you at the Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Malcolm X, man. Yeah, dead the president. Alfred Hampton, man. Revolution, man. Man. All tight, soldier. See. All boy, all tight. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot, cop shot. Keep shooting my people, we will shoot back. Me bring the M1, you bust the clock. Rap a bum bum bum, oh yeah, like that. 187 pun undercover cop. Another dead pig, now stay off my block. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot. Black cop, white cop, all cop.
Every police is a punk ass bitch. This is for my niggas in the street.
That wraps up our January 2010 edition of No One Is Illegal Radio, a special on the upcoming Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity. The Forum Against Police Violence and Impunity is a Montreal-based collaborative effort by grassroots social justice activists and community organizers to create a space that will allow for discussion, sharing experiences, and developing strategies in the ongoing struggle to live free of police violence. The forum will take place between January 29th and 31st at the Park Extension Community Center. For full details about all panels, workshops, skill shares, and more, check out the website www.forumcontrelaviolencepolicière.net. This month's show is produced by members of No One Is Legal Network in Montreal. Special thanks to Neil, Francine, Loira, and Will. No One Is Legal Montreal is part of a worldwide movement of resistance, fighting for justice and dignity and the right to self-determination for migrants, refugees, and Indigenous people. Our campaign is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, denouncing and taking action to combat racial profiling, police brutality, detentions and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island. See you at the Forum Against Police Violence at the end of the month.
Is a government policy? No justice, no democracy. This a modern day slavery. Fire burn all country. Cop shot, cop shot, cop shot, cop shot. Black cop, white cop, all cop.
That's the sound of the beat.
Enough and dying in the streets.
Take a shot at the Capri.
No justice, no peace. Why?
In the field.
All right, boy, lick a shot, all tight. You done no sin.
It's too real for your radio.
You done no it.
Too raw for your video.
You can't test
DPs on your stereo.
You don't want
it. Motherfuckers don't hear me, though. Yeah. Yeah.